option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with the reporters.
The fifth export potential exhibition of the Islamic Republic of Iran, dubbed Iran Expo 2023, has officially kicked off in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi inaugurated the exhibition. During his speech, Raisi hailed Iran's progress despite sanctions, saying Iranian scientists and industrialists have managed to make great achievements. He also said that the Iranian government has set a 40-year record exporting over $50 billion worth of commodities since August 2021 when his government came into power. Since the early hours of the opening, the exhibition salons were packed with investors and business people from every corner of the world.
We have come from Burkina Faso and are very happy to participate in the Iran Expo exhibition. Our area of activity is processed agricultural products. This event has brought together a lot of businessmen and entrepreneurs from around the world. It's our honor to be part of this expo.
We come here to Iran many times, and it's safe, and it's nice people here, and we are like a brother. No any problems. Actually, I encourage people to come here to Iran. It's a very fantastic country.
Representatives from 60 foreign countries have participated in this year's event. The UAE, Pakistan, Russia, Turkey, and China are among the countries taking part in the exhibition. There are a total of 750 domestic companies and representatives at the event that have put their products on display in different industrial, medical, and petrochemical areas, as well as home appliances and food industries. The fifth export potential exhibition of the Islamic Republic of Iran showcases the trade and investment opportunities in the country for foreign businessmen and entrepreneurs.
I want to thank the Iranian authorities for having the great idea of holding this exhibition. We are interested in cooperation with lots of companies here, especially pharmaceutical procedures, as well as those involved in construction.
We are here from China, and our country has very good diplomatic relations with Iran. China is also vigorously promoting partnership with Iranian companies. We hope that Iran continues its path of progress, and today we're here to see the products Iranian companies can export to China.
The exhibition will be held from May 7th to 10th. Iranian officials have estimated that the expo will help add more than $2 billion to the country's export revenues.
Iran Expo 2023 provides a platform, a perfect platform for investment in non-oil industries of Iran. And the presence of thousands of people in this year's event highlights this fact. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida became the first Japanese leader to visit South Korea for a bilateral summit after 12 years. Despite ongoing historical disputes, President Yoon has reached out to Tokyo with plans to possibly include Japan in its alliance with the U.S.
Washington. Both countries are exposed to North Korea's nuclear threats, and the military cooperation is needed more than ever. The Washington Declaration at the moment is an agreement between South Korea and the U.S., but we do not rule out the possibility of Japan's participation.
Japanese Prime Minister Kishida sought to reassure South Koreans over the impending release of contaminated water from the 2011 nuclear disaster. He also welcomed the opportunity for Japan to participate in a network of military alliances.
North Korea continues to carry out provocations in the region, and there is a sign that there is an attempt to change the current status by force. Based on this assessment, we agreed we have to strengthen deterrence and ability to respond to threats through Japanese-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-Japanese alliance, and the trilateral alliance.
Both supporters and detractors rallied outside the presidential compound. Many opposed President Yoon's outreach to Japan and militaristic pro-U.S. policies and question his patriotism.
Is President Yoon Suk-yeol, who is driving the Korean Peninsula towards Cold War confrontation while taking the lead in representing the interest of the United States and Japan, is he really the president of South Korea?
South Koreans have also been critical of President Yoon for creating a South Korean foundation to compensate victims of Japan's colonial rule. Improved relations between South Korea and Japan will no doubt be welcomed by the U.S., which wants to see a strengthened trilateral military alliance. And despite domestic opposition, President Yoon seems fully committed, with the largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated to start later this month. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know? Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why there are many mainstream platforms. So what the royal family stands for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises, could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Showing absolutely no remorse. These are the confessions of the man that led the Harakat al-Nizal separatist group, responsible for several terrorist operations in Iran that left over 450 casualties in a span of 15 years.
According to our plan, our members received military training. That is because we wanted to give the impression that Harakat al-Nizal is strong and can carry out military operations. We even started our activities with an attack on the governor's office inside the city in a residential area.
Based on the theory that the end justifies the means, the Swedish-backed terrorist ringleader masterminded one of the deadliest terror attacks in Iran. In 2018, the attack on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz killed at least 25 people and injured 70 others, many of which were civilian onlookers.
You could say that all of those who were killed or injured in the attacks were ordinary civilians. We really didn't care. Even many of them were Arabs, and that was okay. We just wanted everyone to know about us. We want people to know Harakat al-Nizal.
The Harakat al-Nizal terror group has been pushing to separate the southwestern province of Khuzestan, which is home to Iran's Arab population.
Arab, Turk, or Persian, we are all Iranians and we will always remain united.
I took part in this funeral to show my support for the Islamic Republic and our leader Ayatollah Khamenei. We are one and nobody can divide us.
Today, I came here to send a message that we will always remain united.
Habib Farajullah Cha'ab, nicknamed Habib Osaivand, head of the terrorist group, was arrested in 2020. He stood trial in 2022, where he pleaded guilty and was convicted and sentenced to death. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence, and he was executed on May 6th. His mission remains a failed plot. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
A vigil was held in Gaza denouncing the latest Israeli crimes in Nablus, which led to the killing of three Palestinian men and a woman. Israeli occupation forces raided Nablus city on Thursday morning and assassinated three freedom fighters. Israeli army claims that the victims are responsible for the resistance operation in the Jordan Sea last month. People from all walks of life in the besieged Gaza city came out in solidarity with the West Bank against the Israeli regime's atrocities, confirming their utter support for the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank.
Those who were killed by the Israeli occupation were defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and killing them in cold blood is a war crime committed by the Zionist criminals. These crimes would only increase the Palestinian resistance actions and strengthen their unity against the occupation forces.
Al-Ghul insisted on the unity of the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza and the West Bank.
We urge the Arin al-Usud resistance group and all freedom fighters to unite. We are with you from Gaza, the 1948 occupied lands, the West Bank, and even from outside Palestinian territories in Lebanon and Syria. We are all awaiting the leader Mohammed al-Daif's commands to start battle and free Palestine.
On a separate incident, the Israeli forces murdered a Palestinian woman in Hawara town in Nablus. The assassination raised the death toll of the Palestinians to at least 102, including 20 children so far in 2023. During the vigil, people chanted slogans in defiance of the Israeli occupation and called for retaliation.
The Palestinian resistance is much more experienced against the Israeli occupation. They started with nonviolent approaches and then raised the bar for the Zionist enemy due to its brutality against the Palestinians. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank learned lessons from what happened in Gaza and are now following their footsteps. The Israelis know that the resistance is now invincible. They're certain that the resistance is able to bring them down, especially when the Netanyahu cabinet faces serious challenges in the occupied lands.
Tensions have been escalating in the West Bank in the past months. The Israeli army has intensified its operations into the Palestinian cities and towns, during which they arrested and killed tens of Palestinians. The Israeli regime commits human rights violations and war crimes on a daily basis against the Palestinian people across all Palestinian territories, and with every crime, it knows that it becomes harder to restrain the Palestinian resistance actions. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages across the 27-nation eurozone will soon start paying back even more following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by a quarter of 1%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.
So we are talking about $1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that labour shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience, or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Italy-France government relationship appears to be again in freefall after French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said on Thursday that the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is incapable of solving Italy's migrant crisis on which she was elected. The derogatory remarks, also reiterated by French Transport Minister Clément Beaune on Friday, have caused uproar in the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni is said to be on the verge of cancelling a planned trip to Paris to meet French President Emmanuel Macron, while Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has demanded Paris an apology for what he called gratuitous and vulgar insults towards a friendly and allied country.
This rift of immigration can be framed in a European context with Italy that has repeatedly demanded to improve the burden distribution across the EU. This umpteenth diplomatic spat between Rome and Paris takes place on the backdrop of a new humanitarian emergency in Sudan, which can greatly exacerbate the migrant crisis.
Rome and Paris have often been at loggerheads in recent years. The latest rift dates back to November last year, when a French NGO-run search and rescue vessel carrying more than 230 asylum seekers was refused a port of safety by Italy's government for around 3 weeks. On that occasion, in response to the situation, the French government suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees who had landed in Italy, contravening the European Union's migrant relocation mechanism.
We firmly believe that Brussels must develop a coherent approach to distributing the migrants across the EU. About 94,000 migrants landed in Italy in 2022. You know how many migrants were relocated to France? 38. And to Germany? 57.
Later on Friday, Paris sought to play down the fresh row with Rome, saying that Italy is an essential partner to France and their relationship is founded on mutual respect. Meanwhile, migrant arrivals in Italy have more than tripled from last year. The country's recent centres are overcrowded and some have passed the breaking point. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight.
The British Bureau of Statistics announced a significant increase in the unemployment rate, which shows the first effects of the economic recession following the energy crisis and the sharp increase in the cost of living in Britain. Unemployment in the United Kingdom has risen dramatically, and the government is now looking for new sources of income and spending that can curb this trend. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Website of Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. The official figures showed the UK unemployment rate has edged up unexpectedly, highlighting a faster-than-expected spike in wage rises in the face of skyrocketing inflation across the country. According to the figures presented by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, on Tuesday, Britain's job vacancies have fallen for the ninth straight month in a sign that the uncertain economic outlook is heavily impacting the British job market. The data revealed that the unemployment rate also rose to 3.8% in the 3 months to February, the highest level since the second quarter of 2022, while vacancies fell by another 47,000 in the first 3 months of 2023. The increase in the unemployment rate appeared as a surprise for the government, as most economists had expected the rate to remain unchanged. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said firms continue to cite economic pressure as a factor in holding back on recruitment, as they can't afford employees' wages. Meanwhile, total pay, including bonuses, grew at an annual rate of 5.9% in the 3 months to February. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, regular pay, excluding bonuses, also continued to rise by 6.6%, but down by 3.4% with Consumer Prices Index inflation taken into account. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee is watching wage growth carefully for signs that inflation is remaining stubborn and may consider raising interest rates once again in May in the light of recent figures. Martin Beck, the chief economist advisor at EY Item Club, said, given the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee's wariness around inflation's persistence, February's strong rise in private sector regular pay could easily shift the majority in a more hawkish direction. Ellie Henderson at Investec Economics added, we think that on balance, the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England will raise the bank rate by 25 basis points to 4.5%, but that will be the last hike in this tightening cycle. Eddie Henderson added, today's data release arguably supports that call. The labour market is still tight, suggesting a further tightening of the screws. The economic pressure and the cost of living crisis have prompted many workers across different industries to hold industrial action now and then, causing disruption in services in different sectors such as Royal Mail, British Rail, National Health Service, the NHS. Junior doctors are the latest group to strike, seeking a 35% pay rise to compensate for below-inflation pay rises over more than a decade. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, Discontent over pay in the public sector saw 348,000 working days lost to strikes in February, up from 210,000 in January. It has been worried that pay growth to match inflation only raises the already surging prices. A cost-of-living crisis driven by sharp food and energy price increases has left the British people struggling to pay their bills. The Conservative government argues that pay increases would increase inflation, which currently stands at 10.4%. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. The fallout from the wave of strikes was underlined on Tuesday, 18th of April, with figures showing nearly 350,000 working days were lost in February. The number of days lost due to industrial action was up to 348,000 from 210,000 the previous months, with almost three-fifths down to the education sector. The number of stoppages hit 654, the highest ever recorded by the Office for National Statistics, with 250,000 workers involved. Just under 1.4 million days have been eradicated since December, a month when the level reached 826,000. Strikes have been taking place across the National Health Service, Education, the Civil Service and Rail, as workers demanded higher pay amid the cost of living crisis. The Office for National Statistics data show that the highest number of stoppages in a previous month was 530 back in 1970. The figure appears to have been pushed up because school strikes are counted as separate disputes between staff and their direct employer, which can be academies or the local authority. The stark numbers were revealed in statistics showing the jobs market defying the economic slowdown, but real-term wages are still tumbling and long-term sickness has hit a new record. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, claimed unemployment is still close to historic lows, despite official figures showing the rate nudging up from 3.7% to 3.8% in the 3 months to February. Pay continues to be outstripped by surging inflation, with total wages, including bonuses, up 5.9%, but down by 4.1% when headline Consumer Prices Index CPI is taken into account. Worryingly for the Bank of England, which is trying to keep a lid on prices, regular private sector wages were increasing faster than expected at 6.9%. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. The real value of UK workers' pay continued to fall at the fastest rate for more than a decade, as wage increases in February were outstripped by high inflation. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said annual growth in average pay, excluding bonuses, held steady at 6.6% in the 3 months to February, despite a small rise in unemployment and decline in the number of job vacancies. Fueled by bumper pay for bankers and accountants in the City of London, wage growth, including bonuses, rose by 5.9%. Economists had forecast weaker rates of pay growth in a potential dilemma for the Bank of England as it considers whether to raise interest rates for a 12th consecutive time in May. However, the Office for National Statistics said total pay fell by 4.1% on the year after taking inflation into account, among the largest falls since 2009. Reflecting softer conditions in the jobs market as Britain's economy struggles for growth momentum, the unemployment rate unexpectedly rose to 3.8%. The number of job vacancies also fell for the ninth consecutive month, although remained high at more than 1.1 million as companies struggle to recruit staff. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said, "While unemployment remains close to historic lows, rising prices continue to eat into paychecks, which is why halving the inflation rate this year is one of our top economic priorities." Average wage growth in the public sector picked up to 5.3% on the year, the fastest annual rate since 2005, although continued to lag behind wage growth of 6.9% in the private sector. Paul Novak, the Trades Union Council General Secretary, said the figures showed workers were suffering the longest wage slump in modern history. Calling on ministers to resolve pay disputes, Paul Novak said, "Hard-pressed families can't take much more. It is no surprise that workers are having to take strike action to defend their standard of living."
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. All human blood may be red from a physiological perspective, but in the United Kingdom, blue blood rules. The coronation of King Charles III is living proof of that, as it took place on Saturday with much pomp and circumstances and a £250 million price tag for the British public. In a country where the quality of life continues to deteriorate for the average Brit, it becomes more obvious that the pomp is for a privileged few and pressure for the majority. Well, I'd like to talk about all of this on this Spotlight. Welcome my guests to the program. Lembit Opik, former member of British Parliament, out of London. And Nick Napier, activist and commentator out of Edinburgh. Thank you both for being with us. Well, actually, you're in Seattle, I guess. So, okay, I saw something else up there. You're in London.
This is The Spotlight The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Anyway, what does it mean, Limbit, to have a hereditary monarchy in the 21st century?
First of all, apologies for very poor sound. I couldn't make my normal hands-free work. In terms of your question, it means that a majority of people in the United Kingdom still do seem to support the monarchy, but the monarchy has to justify itself economically now. As you said in your introduction, Britain is a poor country. Relatively speaking now, it has huge economic problems. And the hundreds of millions that this coronation has cost really needs to be repaid, at least in terms of tourism by the royal family. But more than that, my biggest concern is that the government doesn't understand the contradiction. I don't really blame King Charles for the stupid economic decisions made by prime ministers. King Charles wasn't elected. He's a hereditary head of state. But the politicians should at least have explained why it's okay to spend this enormous amount on the monarchy rather than simply trying to suppress opposition. I think it's legitimate, regardless of my own views, legitimate to be a Republican. But you shouldn't have to justify yourself or get arrested for having taken that position. So fundamentally, it's the politicians rather than the royalty that I blame for the pressures that you rightly outlined in your introduction.
Okay. Well, Mick, your perspective and your belief system in dealing with this hereditary monarchy in the 21st century, when it's a country that always lectures others about equality, human rights. I mean, your overall assessment, Mick.
Well, I agree with the great British political revolutionary of a couple of hundred years ago, who was very influential in America and France, Tom Paine, who said it was as ludicrous to have a hereditary head of state as to have a hereditary carpenter or plumber, or he would say today, IT technician. It makes no sense, but it makes sense in one way. If we look at the three elements of the British state, the House of Commons is elected, the second chamber is unelected, and the monarchy, of course, by definition, is unelected. So there are large parts of the state which are not open to the will of the people. And although the demonstrations in London today and elsewhere, I haven't kept up with them, were quite modest, it's difficult to tell what percentage of the population sympathises with them. I mean, when I was younger, it used to be in every cinema, in a time when cinemas were the main method of public entertainment, that people were expected to stand at the end of the evening's performance for the national anthem. Well, because nobody stood but rushed for the exits, that particular institution was retired, because there was no support for it. It's difficult to know what the support for the monarchy is in any real sense. You can measure numbers, and older people tend to be much more conservative and much more pro-monarchy. Among young people, it's a very different story. Mm-hmm. And the last numbers I read were that 40% of people under the age of 25, preferred a monarchy and something very similar preferred a republic, and something very similar for those under 35. So it's difficult to measure. It's also difficult to measure because although a fellow guest says it's not illegal to be a Republican, it's certainly disparaged in the mainstream media. We learned a few days ago that the BBC, in its meticulous and expensive publicly financed preparation to cover the coronation, actually puts its footage to the palace, first of all, for its agreement. So in a very real sense, the chunk of the population who are Republican in sympathy, or the equally large proportion who don't care and don't support the monarchy, okay, their views are filtered out.
Well, Limbitt, pro-royalists, when answering critics, say that the Queen, or now the King, is mostly a ceremonial role. How can that be said when technically he can appoint and dismiss ministers and even declare war?
Good question. And it's down to the behaviour of the royal family. Now, I won't give you a history lesson in British monarchy, but hundreds of years ago, one member of the royal family, one king, ended up in huge trouble for trying to push Parliament around. Different politicians and different monarchs get on to different degrees. And the big question isn't so much the constitutional position, because, as you've just heard, it is theoretically a ceremonial position. It's the extent to which the monarchy seeks to influence Parliament. But here it gets complicated. With a good political system, with a good Prime Minister, with a good Parliament, everything's beautiful. It works well. The monarchy perhaps is a nice adornment, a nice, beautiful thing to look at, something that brings tourists to the UK. But if the government is weak, the monarchy becomes more powerful. And that's what ironically provokes republicanism and makes it harder for the monarchy to justify itself. But that's because the elected politicians aren't doing their job. I actually think that's the situation we're in now.
Well, Mick, with rising food prices, rents, and much pressure on the National Health Service, NHS, do you think the average British citizen benefits from the presence of the monarchy in general?
It's very patchy. I just saw the much-hyped call to come together in the main square of Glasgow, my native city, to celebrate the monarchy and even to take a vow of allegiance. And the square was empty. There was a huge big screen available for anyone who wanted to participate, but people had voted with their feet or actually by not using their feet. So given that today we have millions of people relying on food banks, that most people have a very genuine sense that the much-loved National Health Service, one of the gems of British culture, is in danger and is being whittled away government after government. The fact that when, you know, people who are now in the internet economy actually delivering goods around the country earn such low wages that they have to drive dangerously in order to make a living. And, you know, my daughter lives in Berlin and lives quite well in terms of being young, but being able to rent a house where the rent controls are very, very significant. Young people in Britain are finding it impossible to live, certainly to buy a property, but to pay rent, which doesn't reduce them to dire straits. So life is hard, and in that situation, the monarchy is an institution of the state, and the views of millions and millions of people intersect in the person of that monarch. Some support it, some despise it. But at the moment, there's a widespread sense among the experts, and in fact, John Curtis from Strathclyde University is widely seen as the leading pollster in the country. He's saying that there's still a majority for the monarchy, but really it needs support because the support is ebbing away, especially among young people.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Limbit, in a country where basic staples have skyrocketed and 1 in 10 kids are facing poverty and even working people, such as teachers, where 1 in 5 are experiencing food poverty, in general, why would so much money be spent for the royal family? And a lot of it, especially if what we saw today, again, being funded by the working class. It just seems, where's the equity in all of this?
Well, there is no equity in it. The difference between the richest 5% and the poorest 5% in the United Kingdom is horrendous. In many ways, we're like a third world economy where if you've got it, you can get richer. If you haven't got it, you can't even afford to pay your rent, as my colleague has just said. But there's a different question to ask here. Does the royal family do more good than harm? Now, I have to say that in terms of the opinion polls, my personal view is that most people in politics in Britain do still feel that the monarchy is relevant and they want it. One of the ironies is that oftentimes the Queen was preferred as the person to run the country more than the Prime Minister. And then I move to my second and perhaps the central point here. The lack of equity isn't because the royal family have made stupid mistakes in government policy. It's because the government has made stupid mistakes in government policy. If the UK really was a superbly wealthy country, then actually the royal family, even if it was making a slight loss, is an affordable luxury. I suspect the royal family does make quite a lot of money in terms of economic turnover. But fundamentally, the problem is the argument has not been made satisfactorily by politicians. And what I think we now see is a potentially popular King Charles III and a potentially extremely unpopular political situation where the Labour Party and the Conservatives, the two main parties, simply aren't talking to the country. And here's the biggest irony. Imagine if I'm right. Imagine if King Charles III becomes a more attractive leader of this country than the people that we elect. So, yes, it's expensive, but it's far more expensive to the UK if the public preferred the unelected royalty than the elected government.
Well, it's interesting what you said, Limpet, because it already appears that Charles doesn't have a whole lot of charisma. I mean, because when talking or looking at people's statements, our correspondents on the ground there, there were more positive said about the Queen, of course, in her 70-year reign, and there was a bit of a reassurance perhaps given by her. And she stayed, for the most part, tried to stay out of controversial domestic matters, whereas Charles, even as prince, was not so successful. So it doesn't seem that he's going to have a whole lot of charisma during his reign. I mean, your take. Go ahead.
I've been lucky to meet him a few times. Actually, at a personal level, I have to tell you, I've just got to tell you the truth. He is charismatic.
Okay.
He's likable. He's quite charming and he's very funny. But he's also quite political. The Queen, especially on things like the environment, the Queen was careful not to be quoted in public. Sometimes she was, and that caused anger to the royal family and to the advisors. But she had 70 years to build her popularity. King Charles has only had one, and let's remember that the royal family under the Queen about 20, 30 years ago was really unpopular when Princess Diana died in that terrible car crash in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem for King Charles is he is not the master of his own destiny. How the public feel about the interrelationship between the head of state and the head of government, that's a really big factor. Can King Charles be as popular as the Queen? Maybe, but he won't have 70 years to do it. I watch with interest what he does. I want him to do well. The Queen did, I think, very well in her role. King Charles didn't choose to be born into the royal family, and he has got a duty of care for what his responsibilities are. Maybe others say that we will become a republic. I don't think that's going to happen soon. And therefore, if I was King Charles, the next time I met the Prime Minister, I would say, you've got to do a good job so that I don't get the rep for your bad behaviour, because I can't come into the Commons, knock on the door and take over, even if I'd like to.
Right. Well, he didn't choose to be a king or part of the royal family, but, you know, £250 million worth personal fortune of £1.8 billion. It's not a bad position to be in for him, I'm sure. Well, Mick, overall, I mean, we've talked about the stark contrast between the older and younger Brits and the existence of the monarchy in general. And today, with the coronation taking place, there were protests and chants of "Not my king." Do you see the role of the royal crown diminishing in the future, or your overall assessment?
Well, we have to define what the role of the monarchy is, and I think it's overwhelmingly symbolic. It's a symbol of grotesque privilege, lording it over, great poverty and great lack of security. I mean, there is a political element here of real power. There was I can't remember the year, but an Australian government was dismissed by the Queen's representative, the government, the Governor General. And she dismissed a left-wing government and opened up the road for a right-wing government to replace it. And Australians remember this very, very well. So although the powers are residual, they remain real in periods of crisis. Lembit mentioned the situation when Princess Diana died. It wasn't a political crisis, but it was a profound crisis for the royal family. They trembled in their palace because a spasm of powerful emotion went round the country, which measured Princess Diana very favourably against the rest of them. And that crisis it's essentially a corporation, the royal family, but that crisis inside the people who managed that corporation was very profound and very real. And they managed to ride the wave of rage and anger, but it might have been quite a close-run thing. But the main thing about the monarch is it symbolises privilege, it symbolises inherited wealth, it symbolises the domination of people who may lack any quality, any redeeming quality, but who solely by virtue of the bed into which they are born becomes head of state or become a group of royals who have a huge, huge silver spoon in their mouth. So it's that grotesque endorsement of inequality which I think rankles with millions of British people today. Difficult to tell how it will take shape, how the Republican movement will develop, but I think John Curtis is right. Although there remains a majority for as measured by pollsters, the foundations look increasingly shaky. And unless there's action taken to strengthen them,